It was 75 years ago today that the first Boeing B-17 Flying Fortress took flight. And on this anniversary evening, it seems fitting to us that the man known as Mr. B-17 would be with us to share his memories of flying that famous bomber. Colonel Hal Weekly flew B-17s in combat during World War II and survived being shot down over France. He returned to the States to become a B-17 instructor and later a jet instructor, retiring from the Air Force after 26 years. Then he joined the FAA as an operations inspector and an accident investigator. In 1979, Hal began flying EAA's B-17, Aluminum Overcast. He is the last B-17 aircraft commander and the only aircraft commander to fly the B-17 in two centuries. Ladies and gentlemen, it's an honor to welcome, and would you please welcome, Colonel Hal Weekly.
Thank you, thank you. A couple of things before we begin. First, can everyone hear me okay? First, I was reminded that Henry Ford once said that never stand when you can sit, never sit when you can lie down, and I've added to that, but make sure you can stand back up. So, but I am so pleased to be here and so pleased to see you out there, and I hope that there's several people here that have flown with me on the B-17. I did it for 23 years. And retired in 01, and like he said, he missed one part. I was the only one to fly it in two centuries, and also in two millenniums. That's why I flew it to 01. So I flew it till I turned 80, and then I quit, and everyone said, why are you retiring now? I said, you need to retire when everybody hates to see you go. You stay too long, they don't give you a party. So we had a great party right here, 80,000 people, and my family was here, and we had a great time. But I wanted to, before I get started in what I'm going to say, and which could be anything, because my wife says I can give you 1,000 words on any subject you pick. But I wanted to tell you a story. Last year, I met a sergeant that retired. He was giving a talk at the 700th Airlift Wing in Dobbins Air Force Base in Georgia. And he was the number three maintenance man. He was a maintenance man on number three engine of Air Force One. And I've never told this story, but I thought it was a great one, and I just wanted to pass it on to you up tonight. They've given me 45 minutes, but I doubt if they can get me stuff if I get going. So it just so happened that there were four guys, Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps, who were in a bar having a few cold ones and getting pretty loose with the tongue, and they were arguing about which was the best service. And after a while, they got tired. They said, let's go across the street, try that bar and see how that works. So they walked out in the street, and they weren't looking and got hit by an 18-wheeler and killed all four of them. Well, they went up to the pearly gates, and St. Pete's sitting there. They said, what are you guys doing here? He says, well, we had a big argument. I'd like for somebody to settle this argument. And he said, well, I don't want to get involved in that. Let's just go ahead and we'll turn that over to God. So he said, I'll take the information down to him, and we'll discuss it. And God sent back a message, I'm sorry I can't be with you. I know you worked this thing out. It seems to me everything's quite obvious. And so we'll talk with you later. Signed, God, Air Force retired. I enjoyed that, and I was hoping you would too. Well, I've added a little bit to that of my own. We'll see how that goes. When St. Peter came back, there was a guy there, not too religious. He says, "Hey, Pete," he says, "you've got a porta potty around here any place?" And I said, "No, why?" He said, "Well, I need to relieve myself. Everything's starting to turn yellow." And he said, "Well, I saw a hole over there in the clouds a while ago, but there were some people down there." He said, "That's okay. You go ahead and use that hole right there. Those are the FAA people we keep in that area." So I thought you might get a kick out of that. So, a little something of my own. But I wanted to read something to you here. I don't normally fool with notes too much, but there's a guy here that has given me a problem for years, and his name was Lieutenant Walter Canance of Lamar, Missouri, and Gerard Astor's book, The Mighty Eight, stated the following: "Fighter pilots are usually the top 25% of single-engine advanced training. The rest go to bombers and transports." He further states, "Bomber pilots were generally those who were unfit to be fighter pilots, either by temperament or ability." And the reason I tell you that is because I'm a bomber pilot, so I don't want you to expect too much. I apologize for wearing a hat. I don't normally do that. But as you ladies know, after I shampooed my hair, I can't do a thing with it. I had trouble with the government, as maybe some of you have. Even though I was an inspector for 14 years, I still had trouble with them because I had things I wanted to do. I wanted to fly. I wanted to go in the military and fly P-38s and then work on up. And what happened was when I enlisted for the cadet program, they put me in the combat engineers. So that was number one. And the second thing I wanted to do, I wanted to fly P-38s. They put me in B-17. That was number two. The third thing, I wanted to fly to Europe in my own bomber, and then after the mission was over, come back on a boat so you could sort of spool down a little bit and relax. That was number three. Also, when I went into combat, I said, "Well, if I can just get a couple of these milk runs to start off with, you know, you can sort of get a feel for the thing, and everything will be fine, and then build up to the big stuff." So you know what happened? My first mission was to Berlin. And then the second thing that happened, I got shot down on a milk run. So everything went bad. The government and I, we didn't get along at all. But, I'm sure some of you had the same experience. But what I wanted to tell you a little bit about the B-17, they built 12,731, and they were built in Seattle, Long Beach, and in Burbank. Now, Burbank had the Vega, which later became Lockheed, and the airplane that I flew in World War II was a Vega airplane, and this airplane is a Vega airplane that we fly now. And I don't know if you know it or not, but in 1985, they honored me by painting the EA B-17 in the colors of the one that I flew in World War II. So when you see that one, you see the same thing that I had in World War II. But I was in a 398th bomb group, and we lost 296 killed in action. 298 were prisoners of war or evadees. We lost 59 airplanes, and overall, the military, we lost 4,754 B-17. So that's a lot of machinery. But I thought I might, I know that several of you had dropped in at some of my little talks during the day and book signing, but I thought maybe that I might tell you a little bit about some of that combat experience. We had Nissen, as they call them, which is a small quantity hut, and we had 12 people in each hut. So in our hut was three groups of officers, pilot, co-pilot, navigator, and bombardier. It was Wheatley, Wearney, and Hornshoe. It was the three aircraft commanders there. We didn't call them aircraft commanders then. We just called them first pilots. And the crew was identified by the first pilot. Well, we got to England on the 12th of June, and our first mission was the 21st of June to Berlin. And I'll tell you a funny thing about that. Funny, not funny, weird. But we were getting close to Berlin, and I asked my navigator, we called him Snappy. It's sort of a byproduct of snafu, if you understand what that is. And we called him Snappy. I said, hey, Snappy, where's the target? He says, Skipper, he says, that black cloud over there? I said, yeah. He says, right underneath that. Okay, here we go. But we flew 20 missions all over Europe. Flew lots of missions to Munich and to Berlin, Kiel, some in France, just every place they needed us. And I want to tell you about my last mission, my milk run. We had 36 airplanes. I was leading one squadron, and they picked me out, and they ate me alive. And 35 airplanes went back, and one didn't. And what happened was, at that time, you know, we felt we were pretty good. Of course, we had almost 500 hours. But, of course, I got 24,000 now. But we thought we were pretty good. And I think you have to have that attitude. You know, that I'm, by golly, I can do it. And it just so happened that on this particular day, we were bombing a bridge called La Manoir. It was a railroad bridge, and we were trying to bomb it. It was August the 13th of 1944, which, of course, was after D-Day. And because we were trying to keep the Germans from getting all of their heavy equipment, tanks and trucks and personnel back into Germany, and making it a more of a fortress than it really was, which was bad enough as it was. So we bombed that thing. Well, they picked me out, and to tell you about it, I had number one was feathered, number two was on fire, number three was running away. Number four was running pretty good. They shot out the all my hydraulics. They shot out the communications. Had a fire in the radio room, had a fire in the tail, and I could see the channel up there. We were 25,000 feet. I could see the channel up there. I said, man, you know, maybe I can make it. But about that time, the ball turret came up and told the waist gunner, he told the, see, the communications are all gone. As a matter of fact, my wingmen had spread out like that because they could see I was on fire, and they didn't want to get hit with the parts when it blew up. So and then he told the radio man, and the radio man told the flight engineer, the flight engineer told me, and I don't care how good you are, you got a wing on fire, ain't much you can do about it. So I motioned for everyone to go out, and out they went. Now, during that particular time, the pilots, we wore a harness because we had chest back, 24-foot back, and you could not, you know, have a chest back on and get the yoke back for anything or for landing. So we kept him underneath the seat. So my co-pilot got him out, and I got out, and I reached for my parachute, and it wasn't there. Well, you know, about a minute ago, I thought I was the best pilot in the world. And right now, I'm really scared. But so I turned around, and Joe, my flight engineer, standing there, pulled my parachute. I said, thank you, sir. I hooked that dude on, and out we went. Well, it just so happened that my co-pilot told me later, he said, Skipper, he said, I didn't pull that ripcord. But when I went out, it came open. And what happened was I put the airplane on autopilot. You know, the right engine was running, number four. So it was making a gradual turn to the left. And it was making a turn to the left. It come back by Ben, my co-pilot. And he's there, and it goes around and comes back again, right by Ben again. And he's the holy mackerel. Went through all this, and next thing you know, I get run over by my own airplane. But that, about that time, the second time around, got about over here, and it blew up. And it came all apart. But I wasn't concerned about it because I was checking the parachutes in the air. I had plenty of time because they were machine gunning us from the ground. And as a matter of fact, my navigator at 13, old Snappy, at 13 holes in his parachute. But I dropped 20,000 feet before I opened my chute. But, you know, about against me, 120 mile an hour, that's a hard target to hit. So I'm looking out there, checking my chutes and everything. So about 3,000 or 4,000 feet, I pulled a ripcord, landed in a flax field over there. And two young boys came out and helped me take my parachute. And I asked which way the Germans were. He said that way. So this bright lieutenant went that way. So I went over there and hid in the woods because this was at 1:26 in the afternoon on Sunday. And it's odd because people say, you remember when that was? You better believe it. But I went over there and hid because I wanted to take a nap. Because, you know, we were getting up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And that's another thing that irritated me about those fighter pilots. They'd get up at 5 and 6, and they'd go out and catch it. But we're out there stumbling along trying to get up to altitude. But I wanted to take a nap and relax and settle down a little bit because I knew I was going to have to move at night. So I did meet that evening. The boys tried to tell me to meet them at a church. They pointed out the steeple, and I went back there. Couldn't locate them, but I met a man and his wife and a little girl walking down the road. And we had to be very careful because the French had an underground, and the Germans had an underground as well. And the Germans, they got you. The German sympathizers. They'd turn you into the military, and they got about 500 a person. So they were out there looking for you. But I decided, well, these look pretty good, so I'll give them a chance. And they were good people. They took me to the mayor of this little town, Monsieur Dubac, the little town of Brompton. And they put me up that night in a little room upstairs, and it was about 10 by 10, really, but it was adequate. And they put me there, and I gave them what we call escape pictures. And these escape pictures are about the same size as your driver's license photograph. And we also had escape money with us, French and German. And I gave them my escape pictures, and they made me identification papers the next day. And my name was Ernest Bourdon, Ernest Borden. And what you like is the fact that I was a journalist, but I was also a mute. Now, I have always felt that we could stand more of those right now. But I was a journalist and a mute, and a gentleman, Monsieur Bessie, came in that next day. That would be on the August the 15th, and he had two bicycles, and we started going south. That's where the Allied lines were, and on those bicycles. And as we proceeded down, we went to a friendly farm. Right outside of Ipso, this gentleman's name was Dumanet. And if I always thought that if I was going to be French, Dumanet would be a pretty nice name. But also I had a interpreter and a stroker over there in 99, and his name was Laurent Vuitton. I thought that was a pretty good name too. So I had a decision. But we went down and worked on a farm. I harvested day and harvested wheat, and I'd sit in that dinner table. A couple of Germans come in with rifles, you know. They come in, they want to eat, so they sat across the table from me and sitting there and having dinner, mostly green beans. Boy, it took me a long time to get over green beans. But then the farmer, Mr. Dumanet, he'd take me out in the garden for some reason, and he would try to teach me some French terms. And after a while, he said, just give up. You play deaf and dumb. Well, I was already supposed to be dumb. But I said, okay, it worked that way. So next, they had to move me into town because the kids they had were so pleased to have an American pilot there at their house. They're telling everybody in the area. And of course, it's going to get back. Now it's going to get back to these Germans, these sympathizers. So they moved me into town, and they put me with a gentleman there, Monsieur Renault, just like the car name. And he was an attorney, and like a district attorney in that particular area. And he had been a fighter pilot for the French Air Force until they capitulated in World War II. So we had a lot of conversation. Yeah, but what would happen is he would go to work and he'd put me upstairs in a room and lock the door, and his maid would take care of the house and fix, prepare the dinner and so forth. And when he came home from work, then she would leave. He'd come up and get me. We'd go downstairs, and they would heat up the soup and would talk. And no radios. The Germans would confiscate all the radios. No radios, of course, no TV. So we talked quite a long time.